6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
On December 26, 2017, the Five Nights at Freddy's community encountered a schism that would ripple through its lore discourse indefinitely. The catalyst? The release of an unassuming children's activity book titled Five Nights at Freddy's: The Survival Logbook. At first glance, the book appeared to be a whimsical, tongue-in-cheek diversion meant to entertain younger fans. However, it soon revealed itself as a meticulously crafted in-universe artifact, brimming with cryptic lore and tantalizing implications. This tome ignited fervent debates, fracturing the fandom over what constituted canonical truth versus speculative theory. Among the many theories born from this release, one emerged as arguably the most monumental and contentious in the franchise's history: the identity of the enigmatic Golden Freddy. Dubbed the one you should not have killed, this spectral figure was linked to a girl named Cassidy, the golden anomaly and the ethereal fifth victim of the missing children's incident. But the theory didn't stop there. It proposed that Cassidy shared the animatronic vessel with another tormented soul, the crying child, also known as the bite victim of the Bite of 83. Two spirits inhabiting one entity, a concept as provocative as it was polarizing. A theory that forever reshaped FNAF lore as we knew it. Because it never made any sense whatsoever when you really think about it for more than five nights. Hello, my name is Nick Black. Most know me from my podcast, Into the Night, where I cover the lore of the series through an audiobook lens, focusing more on narrative and symbolic elements of the series. During my time covering FNAF lore, I've had some strong opinions when it comes to the series, such as Steelwolf being a lackluster acolyte for the FNAF games, or the Mimic being a character who was poorly implemented due to the reliance of outside media to make even a modicum of sense of its own purpose within the core story of the series. But no comment has ever made the rounds more and more in my years of covering FNAF as my insistence that Cassidy being Golden Freddy is one of, if not the, most illogical theories of all time. And while at the time of the Survival Logbook's release, I could begrudgingly accept the answer put forth by the community, as over 6 years have passed since the release of this dreaded book, the insistence of Cassidy's existence within the canon FNAF universe has not just weakened, it is now provable that it effectively added nothing to the storyline, if it were to be true. Before we begin disassembling what I believe to be an incorrect theory, I first want to begin setting the stage on how I plan to conduct myself in my thesis, the goal of this theory, and also to articulate an importance of sharing a foundation perception when it comes to theory crafting in the FNAF universe. Let's begin with the latter topic: the importance of sharing a foundational perception when it comes to theory crafting in Five Nights at Freddy's. While there are multiple lenses you can utilize to visualize and interpret a narrative, for the sake of time and simplicity, we are going to abridge these perceptions by only focusing and simplifying it to an overall two: objective and subjective lenses. If you are an avid Finance of Phrase theory crafter or a fan of the series, you probably heard the topic brought up before in one of Matt Pat's final videos he ever did. Why you hate my theories. This video was an attempt to bridge the gap between the multitude of tribes within the wider Finance of Phrase community, as it had fractured after the release of Security Breach, the subsequent release of Tales from the Pizzaplex, and the ruined DLC for Security Breach itself. Without going into my own personal belief and impressions of the series, if you want to know more on that, you can listen to any of my review episodes over on Into the Night, where I talk at length about the issues with Steel Wolf FNAF. It is simply a matter of fact that the current course of the series has a new gameplay direction, new story direction, and a new narrative method with the books, and even the overall themes and atmosphere of the games has become more brighter and larger in contrast to the grittier, darker, and more claustrophobic Soul Cawthon-directed series, which has resulted in dividing the fanbase to camps where you wound up in several categories of critique on the matter of the series from a game design and franchise manager perspective alone. As a member of the old guard of FNAF, to call it, I remember when we had our hiccups and idiotic screw-ups when it came to comprehending basic FNAF lore we now know. To go down the laundry list of embarrassments, we had dream theory, where everything is a dream of this one child, an ironclad theory that immediately makes the storyline pointless and can be disproven by the presence of a new game, Mike Trap, where people took a more literal interpretation of Mike's purple skin after succumbing to the scooper that he has to account for all appearances of the purple guy, not realizing how antithetical it would be for this man to become Springtrap in FNAF 3 based solely on logic alone. Or even the classic that still occasionally gets mentioned in passing by theory crafters and narrative interpretations despite the overwhelming evidence against it. William Afton loved his children, and all of his sins and atrocities were for them.
Oh, she stabbed herself.
Yeah, that's funny. That's what you get for being blonde. Oh,
we will divulge more about that in a little bit. But the point that I'm trying to articulate here is that despite the debates we had on the foundational storyline of the series, they were primarily outliers where many were concerned. The major storyline itself was one where the majority of theorists, lore enthusiasts, and just players of the games were able to agree on what events had and had not happened in the series as an objectional base. Then the wider discussion came about on the subjective lens, as we debated the metaphorical, symbolic, or deeper themes that come of those characters' actions or events, or to fill in the gaps in the narrative that the games did not divulge in, such as the culprit and the victim of the Bite of 87, what was in the box in FNAF 4, or even more broader strokes of the appearance and design of Fredbear, Spring Bonnie, and the diner they both lived in. But that is not where Finance of Freddy's is at the current moment, nor has it truly returned to since October 14th, 2021, the release date of the first entry in the Tales from the Pizzaplex series, Lally's Game. Before this book was released, the wider consensus in the FNAF community was that the books, while could be used as material to craft theories, did not represent events that occurred within the wider Finance of Freddy's canon universe. They were instead myths that represent larger lore implications, different interpretations of recognizable events, or experimentation on Scott's part for future horror concepts or story hooks to test the waters out with the FNAF fanbase. With the release of Tales and its first story, Frailty, and its epilogue stinger showing the construction of the Pizzaplex during the time when Freddy Fazbear's Pizza Place, the FNAF 6 location, was above the surface, the entire rulebook everyone was using was thrown out with the bathwater. And we had to start from scratch again, because it felt like the old words of Scott's, which, while chosen carefully, we presume, are now outdated and untrustworthy when it came to the more modern entries into the FNAF literature sphere. It is no wonder in Matt Pat's video he expresses his frustration over how the community now outrages him using the books, as the community had told him these books should not be used because they represent another series of events back in Frights, all of a sudden to now 180, and now outcry that these books were 100% canon with both overwhelming interpretation from the masses.
line used to market the new Tales from the Pizzaplex books. Quote, a collection of new Five Nights at Freddy's short stories set in the world of the newest game. This one line has been used time and time again to say that these Tales from the Pizzaplex books, they are 100% canon, one for one with the game's stories. So many, myself included, have treated these new books in the same way, and as a result, we've gotten lots of hate for it. I mean, it's not an invalid interpretation, it's just a different, less literal interpretation than one that many of you on Reddit are familiar with.
As per usual, when it comes to internet mentality, not providing nor offering any nuance to the discussion and taking everything at blanket face value is the norm. However, despite my respect and admiration of the man, I believe MatPat did not address the clear and crucial problem of the issue, nor addressed the party that could offer the most healing change as pertained to the hostile discussion epidemic at the time, and arguably still ongoing now. Where I believe MatPat got it wrong is when it came down to his feeding into the discussion of no nuance. Oh, you don't believe me? Before even getting into the matter of the community toxicity itself, Matt took a non-insignificant portion of the video in an attempt to defend his Gregory is a robot theory, again, ironically afterwards claiming not to care about the viewer's opinion on the matter.
And honestly, I don't care if you believe this theory or not. I do not care in the slightest. I have no horse in this race.
Yeah, despite taking 10 minutes of the video to go over it in detail, the video itself transmorphs into one about the importance of respecting others' viewpoints when it comes to theory crafting. Alright, that's a fair and respectful message to be sure, but beyond the veiled message of hope, it provided no true call to action or true discussion on the true culprit of this toxicity, the manner of which how to use these new narrative tomes, the book series. In his own video, he quotes from a Gregory novella in the Tales series GGY, where he attempts to use a novella that paints Gregory as mistrustworthy and responsible for the disappearances of several therapists, an event which we know took place in security breach, and latches it onto one sentence where Gregory studies the POV character of the story as proof that Gregory's behavior is that of a robot. Purposely ignoring the fact that A, if he is using the novella as a canon material, it showcases how Gregory can't be a robot due to how much of a social life he has outside of the pizzeria, and B, if you are simply using it as a non-canon interpretive of the story, Security Breach itself outright admits that Gregory had a wonderful childhood and a loving family, making it, again, impossible for him to be a robot. The focus of this Moby Dick of his, that somewhere in the franchise, in the canon universe, there's a robot doppelganger, it took away from the overall discussion that was actually important for the community to have. MatPat then goes on to argue, through the use of a personality survey to bundle cognitive methodology of those engaging in the FNAF series into two categories, sensing, or S's, where people take things at a factual matter-of-fact value, and intuitional, or ins, where people take a more abstract connection to various stimuli and facts, later claiming that, as an in himself, by the way, that being an in is the more correct form of a perspective lens of viewing the franchise.
Honestly, is more in line with statements that Scott has made in the past about the books. The Gregory story, great example. We know how he acts in the game. It is slightly different than how he acts in the books.
System-wide glitch was like a cascade that was broadcasting a very dangerous message. Those subroutines seem to have come from you.
It's not one for one.
The truth is, you had great parents, a great childhood. Why did you lie?
It cannot be literal.
This statement is effectively an argument of ignoring facts in favor of what you are feeling, your base instincts, rather than a carefully formulated case of evidence. Now, abstract thinking and creative interpretations is a boon and a blessing, absolutely. However, it is a different mode of thinking that should not be used at the cost of the objective or the devaluation of foundational facts. This intuition personality trait is basically a faux scholarly linguistic pseudonym for subjective interpretation, viewing the story through a more malleable framework and seeing what comes out of it based on your own preconceived notions and preferred outcomes. The best example I can give to where this methodology for story interpretation would be none other than Crack's After Hour videos, where a group of nerds utilize this framework of thinking to come up with whacking conclusions to their favorite pop culture franchises and movies, utilizing the broader scope of both the material itself and any adjacent material they can attach it to, crafting something new out of it that wasn't intended by the original artist or creators. One of my personal favorite episodes of theirs, and the best one to showcase where this subjective insight has value, is when one of the characters, Mike, concludes that all Arnold Schwarzenegger films take place in the same universe, the Terminator film universe to be specific. The characters then all collectively come to the conclusion that due to Arnold's consistent accent, personality, and callbacks in his own movies to the one role he is most famous for, that every film he is in, besides Terminator 1 and 2, are a simulation the human resistance are putting a captured T-800 through so that when he gets transported back in time in Terminator 2 Judgment Day, he's ready and willing to protect John Connor, the future leader of the resistance, thanks to the emotional educational training those simulations provided for him. Now, did this actually happen? In the Terminator universe, did all these other Arnold movies occur so that the T-800 could be better equipped to deal with a young John Connor in Terminator 2 Judgment Day?
No,
of course not. That is absolutely ridiculous. It doesn't account for the other films. None of the directors working with Arnold have anything to do with the Terminator series. And it's overall just a ridiculous concept to put forward as a fact. But it's a fun interpretation of Arnold's long and established career that makes you momentarily view the original source material in a different, more thought-provoking, and overall appreciative light. But at the end of the day, the original films are not changed, and neither should your takeaways from the original narratives and their themes. That is intuitive thinking, unrestricted en masse, operating on the preconceived story you've already conjured, and purposely ignoring by any and all factual logic that could, and very likely do, contradict it. Even MatPat, in a strange effort to defend this being an optimal manner for theorizing FNAF's timeline of events, uses his Mario is evil theory as evidence.
Is Mario a villain? No, of course not. There are so many examples of him being a hero, but you also can't ignore little details like the time he chained up Donkey Kong or the time that he stomped on his little brother's toe, and that right there yields some pretty interesting conclusions if you connect all those dots, leading to, hey, Mario is a villain.
Yes, the theory in which we all know it is not true, but is a case to bring about a different perspective on the Mario franchise. But at the end of the day, we know that Mario is the heroic knight, Peach is the damsel in distress, and Bowser is the dragon locking her away. So why are you using this manner of thinking to put forth an objective timeline when said manner is operating outside of the bounds of the original creator's intention? People can view art from a multitude of perspectives, but to assert that your manner of thinking is closer to interpretation of the artist's vision, while also presenting the best argument for this manner of thinking, is when conjuring interpretations that yield absurd results for the sake of abstract conclusions that deviate from the storyteller's plot, is to literally lose the plot. You have placed your mode of thinking, your desire for what to be, in the way of comprehending reality, which is the main issue that needed to be addressed in that video and never was, because Matt was too preoccupied with, at the risk of sounding curt, defending his honor. Alright, that may have come across as curt, but I want to clarify that my critique is not an attack on MatPat or the game theory team. I hold no ill will toward them, nor is my intention to discredit their work out of malice. Please don't misconstrue my words as ill-intended when they stem from genuine passion. My concern lies in how certain ideas were framed and the broader impact they had on the community discussion, particularly the way criticism of YouTube FNAF theorist was conflated with outright hate. At the beginning of the video, MatPat equates criticism with negativity, blurring the line between constructive feedback and toxic discourse. But this framing persists throughout the entire video, no matter what the context, where he insinuates that those who critically engage with FNAF theorist, whether on Reddit, Twitter, or even on YouTube, are bad actors at best and just Redditors at worst and not part of his community. But where does that then leave genuine critique? I have a small YouTube following, minuscule, compared to everyone else's. But I do have over 70,000 followers on Spotify. Does that mean any disagreement I receive is inherently invalid because of the work I put into my craft or the size of my platform? That's a flawed metric for gauging the authenticity of an audience. It elevates content creators to an almost untouchable status, where their interpretations hold inherent authority simply due to their reach, rather than the strength of their arguments. This notion, intentional or not, creates an environment where dissenting viewpoints from non-creators are seen as lesser, simply because they don't come with a subscriber account attached. Ultimately, the argument presented in MatPat's video comes across as well-intentioned but misdirected. Instead of fostering discussion that unites the community, the focus shifts towards uplifting content creators at the forefront. That should not have been the priority of the video. Comprehension. There is no manner in which you can decipher a foundational starting point for theorizing FNAF lore anymore that does not contradict another's. What is canon and not canon is completely inconclusive. The video games used to be the only saving grace, the sole bastion. But now, after the release of Into the Pit, a game I love, by the way, even that criteria is now lost. What games are part of the objective timelines? What books, or hell, even novellas in Choose Your Own Adventure tales now, did or did not happen? Well, because of Scott's unwillingness to extrapolate that information, there's no right answer at the given moment. I admire Scott. I admire him as an artist, a businessman, and the embodiment of the American dream. But his silence over how to even use the material he's producing for his world is a poison that is choking the life out of every discussion of not just the narrative's deeper meaning, but even its core storyline and characters, because an inability to agree on how to use the foundational material is, by definition, an inability to build a structure for that material destined to be built upon. To give an example, let's wind back to that earlier claim I made, that William being a father who loved his children is bogus and untenable to the lore in the canon Finance of Freddy's timeline. In the absence of any clear answer, the only truly reliable solution is abductive reasoning. In this framework, we accept a conclusion not necessarily because it is definitively proven, but because it is the most plausible given the weight of evidence for it. When overwhelming evidence supports a particular hypothesis or theory, we then consider it to be true or highly probable until it is contradicted by a primary source. In the case of William Afton loving his kids, despite some actions and dialogue being possible for a subjective viewpoint to interpret his actions to be for the love of his children, its conclusion comes into issue through basic facts of the storyline. Predominantly, it does not account for the death of Charlotte Emily, whose murder occurs before any of the Afton kids' deaths do, leaving William no sympathetic loophole to explain his actions other than his own nefarious self-interest. Or when he committed murder with a smile as seen in the Take Cake minigames of FNAF 2. The second children's incident was unprovoked by any of his children's death and was done so in the open for everyone to see.
Someone used one of the suits. We had a spare in the back, a yellow one. Someone used it.
Furthermore, let's break down William Afton's relationship with each of his own children on a deeper level. Starting with Elizabeth Afton, we see that in such a location, he ordered her not to go near Circus Baby.
Daddy just once let me go play with her. She's so pretty and shiny. Didn't you make her just for me?
Did he do that for her own protection? Possibly. But even that were true, it is doubtful it was from any form of paternal love. In Freddy Fazbear's Pizzeria Simulator, he expresses his admiration for his daughter in the same manner as he does for Molten Freddy. A fascinating experiment that he is intrigued by the outcome by.
Fascinating. What they have become.
In the book that released months after FFPS, The Fourth Closet, while it is not a canon book, in that interpretation of events, it illuminates how William views Cirque's baby more important than Elizabeth, his real daughter. And even further, how he manipulates her to do his bidding by holding out on giving her that parental love and paternal pride she desires. Oh, and he also physically abuses her when she was alive. So, yeah. With the crying child, we can conclude that he doesn't care too much about him if he is allowing his older brother to relentlessly torment him without any form of visible consequence on Mike's part. And the less said about Michael, just the better. The Immortal and the Restless is widely perceived to be a symbolic interpretation of their relationship, where Michael as the baby is unwanted by William. He convinces Michael to go down to Circus Baby's Entertainment and Rentals, more or less to die, and when he doesn't die, William openly tries to kill him in both Final Fantasy Freddy's 3 and, undoubtedly, 6. Again, if he loved his children, why would he openly try to kill one of them? Even in the most recent outside canon media with the Final Fantasy Freddy's movie, William, the moment he faces an inkling of resistance from his emotionally abused daughter, Vanessa in this continuity, stabs her immediately. You may argue his face shows regret, but I would argue that if you love someone, you don't immediately stab them at even the slightest provocation of defying your authoritarian will. Put into frame other crimes like, what was the point of the Funtime animatronics if he was just going to use the remnant of the MCI victims? Or the nightmare experiments as we see in Dittophobia, how he manipulated the children by finding the most broken and emotionally fragile, and therefore the most gullible and easiest to break. This outweighs any evidence for a benevolent interpretation of William to be accurate. Now, the common counter to this claim would be that, well, this part of the lore is just a headcanon until proven undoubtedly otherwise, so you shouldn't be so harsh with your critiques on it. Or that, well, you don't know the exact answer either, so what's wrong with me utilizing this framework interpretation for the characters? I despise these arguments. Again, this is emotion before logic, because the fact of the matter is that why William killed his victims is important. William is the catalyst for almost every event in the series, and one of the major driving factors of the story is the death of the MCI victims, and getting it wrong by concluding he did it for the love of his children, despite the mountain of evidence against because of the sparse evidence for, is, objectively, analytical, indolence. But the true issue that comes with this lethargy is that if anyone else operates on a different understanding of this foundational element of the story, the motivation of its main antagonist, whether you agreed with me or not on that claim, the entire interpretation gets thrown into question. Suddenly, William isn't a malevolent creature who desires only to feel superior to others through instilling fear into them and targets children because they are easy targets for him to slaughter. Now he is a misunderstood, overly benevolent figure who was only trying to get back the child he lost. When people hold these conflicting views on such pivotal characters, it already creates the baseline that they will never agree, because that is such a core detail of understanding and extrapolating on the narrative. The same goes for the identity of Golden Freddy, especially as it pertains to the characters of William and Michael Afton. And after careful investigation, I believe I could present an argument for why Cassidy is not only a false identity for Golden Freddy, but that she has never existed within the Five Nights at Freddy's canon world. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Let's set the stage. To do this, I'm going to be working with the conclusion that all the games are canon. The Survival Logbook is canon, and the Tales from the Pizzaplex and the Choose Your Own Adventure novels, bar Return to the Pit, are also canon. FNAF World, the Silver Eyes Trilogy, and Frights will also not be canon, because the story of all three cannot be compatible within the canon material of even the core Five Nights at Freddy's games. Just a brief rundown as to why these got the cut. FNAF World itself was retconned with the DLC. The Silver Eyes story is incongruent with the games, it's made implicit. And Frights has William Afton survive the fire of FFPS and be put in a hospital in the man in room 1280. But Security Breach contradicts this by showing that the fake pizzeria has sunk below ground, and Tails' first ever epilogue shows that the ground crew working on it never broke Earth, so they couldn't get William out of there. Seeing as the Mimic is also part of the core games now, it gives more credence to Tails being canon compared to Frights, which is why Tails made the cut. I know that all might be a hot take to some, and I've already know I've lost some people and they are clicking out the video already, disregarding everything I have to say. But if you consider that Frights not being compatible with the canon games was a large criticism for them by the overall community back at the time of release, and the fact that Frights is being remade to the games by Megacast Studios, with the lore already being adjusted to fit in the canon universe, I believe at the very least we can agree that the material in Frights is at the very least questionable at this current state, and should not be used as legitimate facts that happened, and only as metaphoric conclusions or events until primary sources are discovered and implemented. Additionally, before we go in, I want to emphasize that despite everything I have said and am about to say, you are not compelled to believe me at any point in this video. I am proud of the work I put in, I know the claim I'm making is a controversial one, and I put in a lot of effort to showcase my findings and conclusion to show a non-hostility to those who believe in Cassidy, but instead show that I am only providing counter-evidence to the existence of this character. It's nothing personal or vindictive. I am confident in my findings. I have gone iron and tongs on it. But yet despite this, I know FNAF lore can be a jumbled mess on occasion. So there is always the opportunity that I miss something. I welcome any and all criticism, and if your argument is solid enough, I will adjust my theories and beliefs accordingly, like a grown-up. Now, we are on the same page for the goal of this episode, and the purview of how I am utilizing the lore and material of the series, let us begin. For the first part of my theory, I actually want to give those who believe Cassidy a fair shake. Before I counter the evidence for her existence within the universe, let's agree that Cassidy does exist. Now, if she does exist, we also have to abide by dual soul theory, the theory in which Golden Freddy has two souls residing inside of it rather than just one, with the second soul being the Crying Child, as the Survival Logbook and FNAF 4 show that the Crying Child is connected to Golden Freddy in some capacity. However, if Cassidy does exist, the primary issue I and many people have on a narrative front isn't just the fact that such a massive lore reveal is sequestered into a children's activity book of all things, but that all the lore that surrounds Golden Freddy in the series relates to nobody but the Crying Child. Let's start with Five Nights at Freddy's 3. As most are aware, FNAF 3 has several hidden 8-bit minigames that lead to a secret good ending to the game. These minigames involve relieving the souls of the MCI, the finale of which involves the puppet attempting to appease Golden Freddy in the minigame titled Happiest Day. However, in order for Golden Freddy to be appeased, every other child of the MCI must also be appeased before Golden Freddy can be saved and all the souls put to peace. So this is Cassidy, right? Well, no. Because if we look at the map of the Happiest Day minigame, we can see the map of the minigame is a mirrored reflection of Fredbear's that we see in Five Nights at Freddy's 4, with the spirit of Golden Freddy and even the positions of the MCI children in the same positions where the Big Bite, aka the Bite of 83, took place. So, the puppet is not appeasing Cassidy here. She's trying to save the crying child, as why would Cassidy be lost in a memory of the events of the Bite of 83? Doubly so, as we see in other storylines of Five Nights at Freddy's, how much memory is tied to the spirits of the dead. Furthermore, perhaps Golden Freddy's biggest claim to fame, trapping William in a hell-like purgatory in Ultimate Custom Night, is additionally unattributable to Cassidy. The one he should not have killed, the child spirit who controls the madness of William's eternal torment, while kept obfuscated on their identities, does have several key attributes that remove Cassidy out of the picture. First, the one you should not have killed is specifically referenced to be a male.
I have seen him, the one you shouldn't have killed.
He's here and always watching, the one you shouldn't have killed.
While some have attributed this male spirit to Andrew, a character present in the Fazbear-Frank continuity as a soul possessing the Stitch Wraith, but primarily as a quote-unquote antagonist in the novella story The Man in Room 1280, a story which has strong themes and connections to Ultimate Custom Night as it pertains to the eternal suffering of William Afton. Unfortunately, two major factors obstruct Andrew from being able to claim the identity as the one you should not have killed. First, Fazbear Frights as part of the series' canon continuity is questionable at best, especially due to tales having elements of its series not just referenced, but directly tied into the modern lore in a manner that cannot be anything but construed as canon, with world-building that directly contradicts Frights. With the DLC update in Help Wanted 2, this is all but confirmed with the Tiger Plush. There's no getting around it anymore. Second, and much more importantly, we see from the final cutscene you can achieve in UCN that Andrew himself wasn't even a candidate to begin with. If you were able to beat UCN with 49 of the 50 animatronics set to 20, the final cutscene shows Golden Freddy twitching and spasming in a deep void, revealing himself to be the one behind William's torment. If Andrew was the one behind UCN, why show Golden Freddy? And finally, evidence that refutes both Andrew and Cassidy as candidates for the one you shouldn't have killed is the mediocre melodies, which reference Michael Afton. One of the rarest Easter eggs in UCN can only be achieved when dying to Happy Frog, Ned Bear, and Orville Elephant. While usually the members of the Reject Gang only say comical lines mocking the players for dying to them, occasionally their moods turn dark and you can hear the faint voice of a child behind them, revealing them to be nothing more than puppets on a string.
He tried to release you. He tried to release us. But I'm not going to let that happen. I will hold you here. I will keep you here. No matter how many times they burn us.
While I know many attribute the FFPS fired solely to Henry Emily, I mean that speech is amazing, Michael Afton played a crucial role in maintaining the facade of the fake pizzeria and keeping all the scrap animatronics in the labyrinth. Additionally, the survival logbook indicates that it was indeed Michael Afton who started the fire in FNAF 3. We know this from the utilization of both the imagery of the FNAF 3 office and the pricing of the coupons that the book takes place in 2023. And we can also see that Michael was indeed the guard both from his name being in the logbook in the beginning and the overwhelming amount of foxy imagery as it pertains to representing the Night Guard, the character who, ever since FNAF 4 introduced Michael, has been somewhat of a stand-in for symbolically representing him, no similar to how Bonnie is often a stand-in for William Afton. Furthermore, let's go into more detail about that survival logbook for a second. One of the larger reveals in that book comes from when the fitted text in the book of one of the spirits inquires, "Do you have nightmares?" And on that very same page, we see that Michael has drawn Nightmare Fredbear in the corner, implying that in FNAF 4, it was he who was having the nightmares instead of the crying child. Now, this has been lore that I have always disliked, as it is one of the most obvious retcons of all time. But with more info coming out of FNAF 4 in recent media, it does seem to imply that Mike was indeed the one having the dream sequences in FNAF 4. The most prevalent of this evidence comes from the recording of Phone Guy playing the background of the FNAF 4 ambience on occasion. Audio that only Michael could have heard. Additionally, we see that he drew Nightmare Fredbear, the only nightmare that doesn't make an appearance in the novella Dittophobia, besides Plutstrap. In fact, Plutstrap has the only excuse for not making an appearance since, as according to the system location layout of Circus Baby's Entertainment and Rentals, Plutstrap has its own testing chamber, separate from the main one and one Rory never went to. Finally, on that same map of the FNAF 4 house, we see only four lights indicating Nightmare Freddy, Bonnie, Chica, and Foxy. We see that these lights are reflective of the animatronics that are active and their placements, and they are the only ones present in Dittophobia. So not only did Michael witness Nightmare Fredbear, but it was a character created from his own mind, not of William's design. But how is that possible? For Michael to have these dreams, would he not need to have been part of the nightmare experiments to begin with? Actually, no. We actually know that Michael could not have been involved in the nightmare experiment through chronicle logic alone. As we see in FNAF 4, Michael's torment of his younger brother is reflective of the enjoyment of the fear he elicits from his younger brother's trauma over the animatronics specifically. If Michael had endured the nightmare experiments, he would more likely be sympathetic to his younger brother and understand what he was going through. In addition, we see that in Dittophobia, that Rory has been trapped within the nightmare experiment for over a decade, since Circus Babies was seemingly abandoned for a period of time. As when Rory escapes the simulation, we see him walking around Circus Babies and encountering Ballora still on her stage. The Funtime animatronics are still present, and over a decade has passed, meaning the events of Sister Location have yet to occur. So again, when did Michael have the period of time to be trapped within the nightmare experiments? The answer? He didn't. Those dreams were instead given to him by another. As we have seen numerous times in Tales and even further in the FNAF movie, the spirits of the dead do have the ability to infiltrate people's subconsciouses when they are dreaming. While these dreams aren't usually as in-your-face as they are in the movie, where the MCI are directly talking to Michael, they often take the form of visions being given by a victim to someone who is either close to or investigating their disappearances. Submagnophobia has the best example of this, as we see the main character in the novella, Caden, be given a strange nightmare about a horde of kids jumping into a large aquarium he was maintaining and being attacked and torn apart by the underwater animatronics in the tank while everyone outside watched happily. The abnormal vision caused him to investigate further and learn that not only did a child disappear in the tank, but their body was still buried in the sand beneath the aquarium, covered up by the owner, who was negligent to guest safety. So, we have set a precedence for spirits being able to influence the dreams of others, but who could be giving these dreams to Michael? Cassidy? Again, incorrect. The answer is once again his brother, the bite victim. We know this from the survival logbook, where the crying child is the one directed to having the question of the nightmares, with his response being, thanks to Hyperdroid's video, "I'm still afraid." But furthermore, there's simply the narrative precedent set by the game that introduces the bite victim and the nightmare animatronics themselves, Five Nights at Freddy's 4, as why would both these stories be connected, played back to back, if they had nothing to do with one another? We also see from the survival logbook that the crying child has to be one of the spirits talking, and is specifically the one altering text within the book to form answers, as when the spirit speaking in faded words ask, "Do you still hear him?" it's in response to a plush Fredbear being on the page, with the spirit who changes text responding back that he does, confirming that the bite victim is indeed one of the spirits talking, and, including the question, "Do you still have nightmares?" implicates that the crying child had these memories of the nightmares as well. Sister Location further cements this with The Private Room, an observation and study for William Afton that links to the nightmare experiments, as seen in both the game FNAF 4 and confirmed in Dittophobia. But we also see in that room a plush Fredbear with some sort of device resting in its lap, once again linking both FNAF 4 and Sister Location and the crying child with the nightmare experiments. Now, Maneva also theorizes the device in the lap of the golden Fredbear plush is a walkie-talkie, but I disagree. The device in question appears to have a joystick knob attached to it that would be unusable for a normal walkie-talkie. But the crucial element to consider here is that the camera controller is not for the camera feed for the nightmare experiments we activate in Sister Location, which is a camera feed only unlocked by punching 1983 in an adjacent keypad, again, linking Sister Location with FNAF 4, but instead, a camera feed directly linking with Plush Fredbear. Or should I say, Plush Fred Bears.
He's here, he's there, he's everywhere. Who are you gonna call?
We know from FNAF 4 that the crying child's fear of the animatronics stem from the robots themselves, and not of the characters. And we know that this trauma is linked to something he saw in the past. While we have had substantial theories in the past in an attempt to answer what the crying child has witnessed, most have come up short. The crying child witnessing the MCI felt apropos, given the statement that the plush characters were his friends, and the teasing remark of the pigtail girl that the animatronics come to life at night, which could be construed to imply that the MCI has already occurred. But by now, multiple instances of the FNAF lore has now associated the MCI occurring in the year 1985, with the most recent example being Into the Pit, which would mean it would be impossible for the crying child to witness the event. Same goes for the crying child witnessing the death of Charlotte Emily, only in this instance it would be a case of being simply too young, possibly not even being born yet, depending on how the dates line up. The crying child, however, witnessing Elizabeth being killed is a possibility, and the ties between Nightmare Fredbear's stomach mouth and how the fun times capture and kill their prey as described by Baby in Sister Location and presented in more detail in Count the Ways could answer why he is so afraid of the robots in particular. There does appear to be an empty room for a girl in the Afton household of FNAF 4, but the death of Elizabeth seems directly correlated with the shutdown of Circus Baby's Pizza World.
I can do something special. Did you know that? I can make ice cream. Although I only did it once.
While we don't know the exact date of when Elizabeth Afton died, or when William Afton was interrogated by the board, or even whenever Sister Location took place, I do not believe that witnessing the death of Elizabeth is a satisfactory answer given Circus Baby's description of events.
There was screaming for a moment, but only for a moment. Then other children rushed in again, but they couldn't hear her over the sounds of their own excitement.
Instead, tying into the previous association with Sister Location in the private room, and the references to FNAF 4, to once again the fact that the storyline of a bite victim in FNAF 4 is told in parallel to the gameplay showcasing the nightmare animatronics, wouldn't a more plausible answer be that William Afton, in an effort to make the most of his assets, put his youngest son through the nightmare gauntlet as a test subject? The plush Fredbear is simply a continuation of his experiment, as he monitors his now traumatized boy. While some theorists far better than me have already argued this, many still hold out on that theory given the lengths William has gone through to monitor his son. Why would he continue to manipulate him through Plush Fredbear by using a walkie-talkie in the nanny cams around the house? Well, again, we simply have to use abductive reasoning to dismantle this notion. First, the amount of plush Fredbear strewn around the house means that William would have to keep a walkie-talkie in each and every one. And that would also mean that Michael would have to be able to hear them and know that his younger brother is being manipulated. While a young and traumatized boy like Dave could be fooled by his father's voice, it is doubtful, given their similarities, that Michael does not recognize his father's voice.
They thought I was you.
Furthermore, we see numerous times in Final Fantasy IV that the plush Fredbear talking to Dave when there is no plush Fredbear in sight. This happens usually when the crying child is in the Fredbear restaurant. But do you know what also happens in Fredbear's during FNAF 4? A secret Easter egg where it shows William Afton helping an employee in a spring lock suit. For William Afton to be communicating with his son, he would need to go somewhere private, talk into a walkie-talkie, quickly sprint back to that room, help the guy in the suit, then sprint all the way back to the private room, which is below ground, by the way, so he can re-monitor his son to let him know his brother is hiding for some reason and trying to spook him. It just doesn't add up logically. Now, this isn't to say that Plush Fredbear still isn't a nanny cam. I think people have been caught up trying to prove the idea that Plush Fredbear is an imaginary friend made up by the bite victim trauma, or that William is strategically using the plush Fredbears to monitor his son, that no one really has realized that there is no reason for why the answer cannot be both. Plush Fredbear is a device that William is using to monitor his son, but it is also an imaginary friend that is a coping mechanism that Crying Child created to maintain his sanity. Scott even subtly communicates this visually in the very first cutscene in the FNAF 4 game. When the first night begins, it opens on a still frame of plush Fredbear with hollow eyes. No life, no camera. The same way plush Fredbear appears on the outside of the family house, atop of the head of flowers and inside the sewer grates. Places where it cannot truly be in reality, because its existence there is simply a comforting mechanism for the crying child. But in the house, where William is monitoring his son, the eyes are lit, and they are actively watching his every move. The only two times the eyes are lit outside the house are in the playground, where a plush Fredbear is stalking behind a fence, because, as a serial killer who preys on the weak and the innocent, William Afton is stalking his prey in their natural habitat. We do see in FFPS that he targets his victims through learning about their trauma and uses it to gain their trust. And the second time is in the final cutscene in the game when Crying Child dies. And here is where I answer probably the biggest question everyone has on the top of their minds ever since I said, the one you should not have killed cannot be Cassidy. How could Bite Victim be the one you should not have killed? Would William never killed him? But I submit that he did. One of the most tragic but infamous elements of the Night 6 cutscene is right after we see Michael lament the fact that he killed his brother and begs that he can hear him to let him know he is sorry. We see a new character speak from seemingly the position of the plush Fredbear. But the text color is different. It isn't the same as before. It's a new speaker, speaking behind the voice of a friend. It's William. He is talking to his son and letting him know that he will put him back together. Before we hear a flat line ring out, William killed his youngest son because William pulled the plug. Again, William Afton wishes to use the most of his assets. After all, if you believe that Elizabeth had already died by the time of FNAF 4, then you also assume that William is currently exploring the boundaries between life and death to find the secrets of immortality already, as were the purpose of the Funtime animatronics. What better way to use the most out of the loss of his son than to see if he could bring him back to life? Not out of love or for pity, but for the self-enrichment and betterment of himself. Because if it's love, we see how that love is not reciprocated in UCN. Whenever Nightmare Fredbear kills William, he is saying lines that directly correlate back to that final cutscene, as if a mockery of those false honey words and reversing them back onto his cruel father.
We are still your friends.
We know who our friends are, and you are not one of them.
I will put you back together.
Let me put you back together, then take you apart all over again.
That last line in particular should ring familiar to those well-versed in sister location.
I put her back together, just like you asked me to.
Put them back together. William did indeed bring his son back to life, as a spirit that takes on the form of a character he loves so much. No wonder why he's so angry at him in UCN. A form of endless torment, where even when you die, you simply come back and the nightmare repeats. Almost like the very same nightmare experiments that William had the crying child endure.
This is how it feels, and you get to experience it over and over and over again, forever. I will never let you leave.
The one you should not have killed, the happiest day minigame, and even the origins of Golden Freddy's ghostly powers, all of it is centered and related to the story of the crying child, of the bite victim, of Dave. The only thing that Cassie could possibly contribute is the killing of William through the Springlock incident. However, given what Dave has endured in FNAF 4 and what he does in Ultimate Custom Night, is it really that far-fetched he would kill his own father this way? And just to put the knife in the wound for any argument against that notion, one final piece of evidence to showcase how pointless Cassidy is to the plot, if she exists, for even the character encyclopedia, when it came to show a page dedicated to the crying child, they chose to use a version of him in the form of the 8-bit children's spirits to showcase the crying child. No different to the other MCI victims. Literally, outright admitting that he is one of them and has appeared as a spirit in the games. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers, while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This marks the conclusion of the first part of our There Is No Cassidy theory. This video has been in the works for a while, and part 2 should be coming out very soon. As always, I'm balancing work on the podcast, finishing our Security Breach audiobook, and uploading more Fazbear Fright content. But I'll try to get part 2 up as soon as possible. In the next part, we'll focus on disproving Cassidy's existence entirely, Now that we've established how all game canon material centers around the crying child, we can shift our attention to the flaws in Cassidy's origins and how her presence ultimately weakens the narrative. My goal in part one was to demonstrate how this debate is somewhat pointless. Cassidy's existence, if taken as fact, is not only unnecessary, but also objectively poor writing on Scott's part. Therefore, part two will be covering how the survival logbook has been misinterpreted for years, the flimsy foundation of Cassidy's origin in the novel trilogy, disproving dual possession, and addressing the conundrum of the crying child being Golden Freddy in relation to the missing children's incident. I appreciate everyone's patience, and I can't wait to dive into the next part of this theory. Be sure to subscribe, follow, turn on notifications, share the project to help support the channel. Thank you to all those in the Night Conclave on our Patreon and Discord server. And thank you, once again, for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.